Hill.
Friday.
On Highway 58.
Barely? Okay. We do not have a quorum to take action. We need a fourth member. We are not going to be taking any formal action on any of the substantive questions here today. The one thing that I will be asking the committee to do when we do get a fourth member is to move the bill and a whole set of amendments, proposed amendments, out to be re-engrossed into an A-engrossed bill, so that in a few days all of the proposed amendments will be worked into one nice clean bill that we can all pick up in the bill distribution center. It's a formality that we have to do. That motion is not going to imply any acknowledgement, pardon the word, of any of the substance of the bill. It's not going to be a vote on any of the substantive provisions of the bill. It will merely be a motion to send the bill and all of the proposed amendments to legislative council to have it drafted into an A-engrossed version, to have it come back in one nice clean form that we can then work off of. Also, Katie Murphy is working on a summary of all of the issues here before us, and will be getting us a finished product sometime next week. The we've received a lot of letters and a lot of phone calls also about Senate Bills 234 and 237, and these are the comments received in person and in writing are being worked into a presentation for the record for the committee. And if you are going to not be able to, if we're unable to get to you today, we will be having another hearing on the bill, but if for any reason you are not able to testify and would like to have something entered into the record, we will enter written testimony into the record. So if you have something that you want to say and either this hearing or the next one are unable to speak it into the record, please give it to us in writing, and we will have it as part of the record when we go into a formal work session. And as far as the work session is concerned, the schedule that you may have seen shows a work session on this bill for next Monday. That work session is going to be just for the committee members to get a brief focus on what the major issues are. Again, we will be sending out all of these proposed amendments to legislative council, hopefully today if we get a fourth member. But the that work session on Monday is going to be very brief and very quick, and no major substantive decisions are going to be made in the provisions of the bill. It's going to be just sort of a filtering out amongst the committee members of where some basic agreements are, where some basic differences are, and what the major issues are primarily. And also, the I have to say before we start hearing from you that we have 2.5 sheets of you signed up, which works out to about probably close to 30 people, or about 35 people. Normally, the committee would spend a lot of time with each witness that comes before us, and we would allow each witness to go on and say whatever they have prepared to say. I would ask instead two things. First, from you, that unless you have a lot of or some new things to say that haven't been said before, that you keep your testimony to the barest possible minimum. We don't want to cut you off, but there's a point where if we let you go too long, we are cutting other people off. So if you have something new to say, something new to add, emphasize that and acknowledge support or opposition to other things that may have been said before the committee. And for committee members, I would ask that we hold our questions, although only Senator Hurd is here to hear this. I'll repeat it when other members come, that we will hold our questions to a minimum. Normally, we like to spend a lot of time asking you questions. We're going to try to keep that to a minimum, too. So between the two of us, we'll get through most, well, a large fraction of you. And then a second hearing which will probably have to wait until a week after next, we will take the rest of you. Okay. We're still at three, rotating. First, I'm running down the list, and we're going to try to get as many people from out of town in today as possible. Leon, and these names I'm going to butcher. I can't always read writing. From Eugene, it starts with an F, Leon H.
That's right. Leon Funk is my name.
Funk?
Yeah, that's right.
Would you want to come testify?
Sure, be glad to.
Okay. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Leon Funk. My address is 90862 Funk Road, Eugene, Oregon, 97401. I'm happy, Chairman, I'm real happy, Mr. Chairman, that you let me come and testify early. My honest opinion, that the gravel people has been robbing the state of Oregon for many years. I've been acquainted with them for the last 15 or 20 years. And where am I located? I'm located on the McKenzie River, about 4 miles before it goes into Willamette. There's from 2 to 3 gravel people as close to our farms. I have 200 acres, and my son has 200 acres of river bottom farm. I think it's a crime for these people to dig in this here kind of soil, because the government built a revetment to protect this land. It washed out. They built another one, and they built a real good one. And it cost us taxpayers a lot of money from the government to build this. Now the county commissioners give them the right to haul this land and to haul this gravel and to haul this loam away. All river bottom soil has from 6 inches to 10 to 15 foot of soil, and then the sand and this gravel underneath. And what they found out is a lot cheaper to get this gravel and mine it than it is to get it out of the hills. Now, they tell you it'll cost more money, but that's false. I can go to Springfield, where they log it out of the mountains, out of the hill, and you can buy that gravel for less money than you buy their gravel. And did you know, not only me, but Sun Pacific has this, buys their gravel that comes out of the hill. It's a better type of gravel. So I don't think there's any argument that they get it cheaper and it costs the people less money. I think that's wrong.
Mr. Funk, the language that we have in front of us for committee members is on page 7 of the bill, and you're referring specifically to, I assume, subsection E, operations conducted for the mining and processing of geothermal resources as defined by ORS.
Yes. Lines 15 and 18 are the amendments.
That's correct.
When you call this mining, then if they take the gravel from the soil?
Yeah.
Yes. And so this is the part of the bill you're referring to?
That's right.
Are you asking any specific requests on that?
Oh, yes. I think it's wrong. I think it's very much wrong that they don't pay the state for this gravel. I think this is terrible. It's shameful. The fact of it is, all you have to do is put a price on this here gravel so high that they have to go in the mountains and gather it, instead of taking it from the good soil or the good farmland.
Okay.
Because,
can I ask you a moment?
Yes, Senator Roberts, a question.
This amendment would require that they couldn't take the gravel until the county, under a procedure, had in effect demonstrated that they had already exhausted those resources occurring on or under soils of lesser agricultural capacity before mining those resources in areas containing soil with greater educational capability. And this language presumably was designed to make sure that while gravel might be needed, and we needed to supply those needs of gravel, you couldn't take it out of the kind of land that you're talking about until they had demonstrated that there wasn't any gravel available under less satisfactory or good agricultural land. That would be a direction that you would approve of. It might not go far enough, but that would be a direction you'd approve of, I take it.
That's right. I don't think they should mine any of this river bottom land. None of it at all. It's shameful because they could get the rock out of the mountain. And for another example, you speak about that. These people go out, and they've been getting zoned for 22 years ahead of time. This is wrong. This is speculative zoning. This isn't regular zoning, because they tell me under regular zoning for a city to take care of. Now, this is Lane County's own figures, not my figures. And this here land, what it brings here is our whole problem is. This here, so they tell me, I've been in the lawsuit, the reason I found out about some of these things, they get $180,000 an acre for this land. That's why they got a little problem. I didn't come down here to make any money. I come down here to save the land. I think you people should save the land too.
Okay. I've asked the people who are going to testify, all 35 of them signed up today, to keep their comments short, and I've also asked the committee to keep the questions short. We'll try to get through as much of the bulk of the testimony as possible. Is there any other specific provision of the bill?
Well, if I can't get my point across, then from 8 minutes or 7 minutes, I won't talk anymore after that time anyway, Mr. Chairman.
No, I think your point was well made.
Thank you very much. Is there any other questions?
Thank you.
Very clear.
Karen Stair. Welcome, and will you please identify yourself?
Yes, my name is Karen Stair, and I'm a concerned citizen. I believe you. My concerns as to Senate Bill 234 and Senate Bill 237 are related to the portions dealing with the schools and churches, and what this bill could either now or in the future involve. I understand the intent of the bill is to protect farmland, but I believe this bill is vulnerable to misuse because of its vagueness. On page 6, lines 25 through 28, it states, a church or school may be established subject to the approval of the governing body or its designate in any area zoned for exclusive farm use if the use meets reasonable standards adopted by the governing body. It would be virtually impossible to define an abstract concept such as a school or church as Americans know them without limiting the creativity of the people. Is a school or a church a building or buildings or the activity that happens within the building? Without a legal definition for school and churches coupled with the phrase reasonable standards, it leaves endless possibilities for application and misuse. This could even legally be applied to me teaching my own children in my own farm home. It would be possible if at some time a school was determined to be a class of 5 students, that me teaching my 5 children could be considered a school. The existing law states that I can teach my own children in my own home as long as we pass certain state requirements. If this bill passes, there is a potential for that freedom to be jeopardized. I am in support of public schools, but I would like to see all options of educational benefits left available to my children. I have observed the problems of the private school in Turner because of zoning. The lack of buildings available and the high cost of those that are make it extremely difficult to locate within city limits. When trying to move out of the city between Turner and Salem, permission was denied because it was zoned for industrial use. The alternative would be for rural property. I would like to see the laws remain as they are to protect the private schools from as many problems as possible. As absurd as it sounds, this bill could legally create a possibility of stopping Bible studies, prayer meetings, religious meetings in and on our own farms by simply defining them as church. We have verified this as a real potential by 2 local attorneys. I have been advised by Mike Ferris, an attorney from Olympia, Washington, that he has defined this kind of, that he has defended this kind of a case. In his opinions, this bill could legally allow these same kind of problems. And I've attached at the back the documents that were involved in that case. My concerns are for the school and the churches. The fact that this portion of the bill could be loosely applied to meetings as well as buildings is of great concern to me. I believe the looseness and the flexibility that this bill allows to interpretation leaves many ways to threaten schools or churches should immoral or unwise people be put in authority. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you very much for coming. The last name is Whitney. It looks like perhaps Sharon.
Sharon Whitney.
Identify yourself for the record, please, and thank you for coming. You're welcome.
My name is Sharon Whitney, and I represent myself, and I'm a local citizen. I am much concerned about Senate Bill 237 and Senate Bill 234 in general, and very concerned specifically about the churches and our public and private schools being put under a conditional use and our reasonable standard criteria instead of an outright permitted use as the law now states. I believe that these ordinances should be left as it is now stated in the existing laws. These above-named institutions, as stated previously during the hearing on Monday the 11th of April 1983, are not a threat to the farmland and this bill is trying to protect. In general, it is the nature of these institutions to be located where there is a need and near the populace of a given community, since long-distance travel is very strenuous to the attrition rate of both schools and churches. In researching these two bills and through checking my conclusions with several legal minds, both in my community and other communities, I found that my rights given to me by the Constitution of the United States, specifically the First and the 14th Amendments, have the potential of being violated. The 14th Constitutional Amendment states, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privilege or immunities of the citizens of the United States. Senate Bill 237 could deny me the right to assemble, which would affect my right given to me by Congress in the First Amendment. I realize that the probable intent of this bill was not to violate the constitutional rights of the citizens of Oregon. Nonetheless, with this bill as it is written, the potential still exists. In research, I found that there is no legal definition of the word churches or schools, and I find the word conditional and the words reasonable standard vague and nondescriptive, which leaves the option open for future possible violations of our constitutional rights. The words or phrases of church and conditional and reasonable standard would have to be clarified to know who and what is to say is a church or school or under what conditions or reasonable standards they could exist. Under such a loose working of an amendment as Senate Bill 237 and Senate Bill 234, people engaging in a Bible study, a song service, singing hymns in the home, doing yoga, practicing transcendental meditation, would all be classified as a church. It is important for me to think that even though I could be residing in my own home, on my own farm within this farm zone, that the ruling powers could take away my freedom of worship and or my right to assemble because of this bill, as my home could be classified as a church at some given time, either now or in the future. Another problem I see with this amendment is with our options within the educational system. As the law now stands, a parent or guardian has the option to remove their child out of the public school system in order to ensure to the parent's satisfaction that their child is receiving the type of education that the parent or guardian deems important so long as it meets certain state requirements. Limited space in the city, exorbitant cost of purchasing town properties or buildings puts a tremendous burden for the private schools to exist as an alternative to the public school system for our children. To keep the quality of education at a high standard, we need the competitive market that private schools provide for the state institutions. We need to keep the schools, both public and private, under the outright permitted use privilege to protect it from dogma that could endanger its quality or creativity or protect it from political views, dictatorial in nature, which could be imposed because of the change in the language from outright permitted use to reasonable standard or conditional use, thus eliminating the freedom of movement for these institutions as we now enjoy. Without the clarification of these words, as stated in this text, this privilege to teach in the home, on the farm, in this area zone for exclusive farm use could be revoked, and the public could then be forced to keep their children in the public school system with no recourse, as the private schools could, by virtue of governmental red tape, be greatly hindered, and this lack of competition could feasibly lower the quality of our educational system and encourage the existence of autocratic states. I feel that we must all be cognizant of the freedoms that we now enjoy, and that this freedom must exist in order to ensure the quality of our lifestyle, and that one can never write or pass enough laws to stop all people from the infringement of laws without endangering too much of the freedom for all of those who reside in the state of Oregon. I perceive the schools and the church to be a very positive influence to our communities in that they raise the moral consciousness and the educational standards of the peoples in which they reside. These institutions must have the freedom to be established where they can economically survive, to move where the people are and have need of them, such as on-hands training in an agricultural setting. For that time, endowed with governmental delays, we must remove the possibility of a dictatorial philosophy being able to govern who could exist. I urge you to leave the schools, both public and private, and churches, and are outright committed to use that is presently enforced. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Jerry Clausen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Clausen. I live in Corvallis, and I'm a part owner of two golf courses here in the Valley. Also a founding member and the first president of the Oregon Golf Course Owners Association, from whom you heard some testimony Monday, I believe. I've also been a golf course business consultant for 18 years, on and off. And during that time, I've been involved in some golf course design and construction. I'm here only speaking for myself as a both a past and a possible future investor in golf courses. There were some questions that perhaps were left unanswered by some of the golf course industry speakers Monday that I thought might need some additional input. And I think perhaps I speak for some persons who might be future golf course investors in this state, of whom I know several. The Owners Association does not represent a majority of the courses in the state. Indeed, it only represents 25% of the courses. And if there was some implication that those speakers Monday spoke for all of the golf courses, I think that that was erroneous, because no vote was ever taken on any policy regarding this particular bill, Senate Bill 234, and what it might or might not do to golf courses. I'm not an expert on the other ramifications of the bill, and I do not intend to speak to them, but I will only say that we very much favor anything that can be done to preserve EFU ground in this state. You may be aware that some of the reason for the proposals in 234 relating to golf courses came about because of Oregon State University and its foundation attempting to put a golf course on EFU land in Linn County, primarily for the benefit of its faculty, staff, and alumni, and perhaps some so-called image that it might generate from having its own golf course. The Linn County Planning Commission did not want such a golf course, and eventually when it made its way to the Court of Appeals said that it was also wrong to do that. Now the OSU and its foundation is attempting to pressure Linn County once again through its staff and its commission to change its ordinance to allow the golf course to be put on that EFU land again. Another point is that we believe that EFU land is not really needed for the future of golf courses in this state. In fact, it's not even the best type of land to use for golf courses in most instances. Such productive land is often the most expensive that can be bought. It is often very flat, has very poor drainage, few trees or natural resources, which can lead to unsafe play. And the only exception I would say that ought to be allowed is if there is an existing golf course that is, for example, 9 holes, it has no choice if it wishes to expand. It must go next door to the land adjacent to it. Sometimes that is farmland, and I do think there should be exceptions to allow that where the golf course already exists, the grandfather clause, if you wish, if the state, in fact, is to make any determination of that situation. We find that in most counties, there are many, many other land zones which would allow golf courses. EFU, of course, is not the only type of land that is available. In Benton County, where I live, for example, there are 8 other rural zones of land besides EFU, and at least 5 of those would, in most circumstances, be better to place golf courses. I think you also heard Monday a speaker say that if this bill is passed intact, it will be impossible to build any more golf courses in the state, and in fact, it's already so difficult that no courses have been built in something like 20 years. Well, that is patently false. Right now, we have 142 golf courses in this state. In 1972, 10 years ago, there were 126, and the increase over those 10 years has been just about in line with the population growth and the demand. 10 years before that, 1962, there were only 75. And my point is that, as in many other businesses and industries where there is demand and there is demonstrated need, somehow, some way, private enterprise will find a way to meet that need and find a way to get golf courses built. And they do not need to take the finest land that Oregon has to get that job done. Land is only one hurdle in a golf course investment. Normally it takes no more than 20 to 25% of the cost of the total development. More important are such things as what type of land it is, its location, its market area, what kind of financing the particular investor has, the design, and then of course the management, as in any business. It is to some degree an emotional investment, but of course for most it is a business investment, perhaps as part of a resort. If the market shows a need, we in the private enterprise end of golf believe that there will always be the way to get it done. And so in summary, I would say that golf in this state, despite our recession, is doing not particularly better, but certainly no worse. This bill, if you in fact delete golf courses as allowable on EFU, it is our opinion that it will do really nothing to harm the golf industry. It will do much to save perhaps major portions of land that are important to the future of this state. And as an aside, I would say we would do just fine the less the government would interfere. If we can keep government institutions such as the OSU Foundation from building competing facilities, subsidized, non-taxable, and we can, through such bills as Senate Bill 549, encourage our county assessors to provide consistent assessment practices on golf course property tax problems, then we should be able to survive just fine. And then the state can finally live up to the spirit as well as the letter of ORS 308.740, the so-called Greenbelt Law passed in the 1971 legislature, whose intent was to preserve the golf courses. I believe that's all I have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let me at this point, while I have everybody here, which is a moment that I want to take some advantage of.
Well, I know the chairman's missing, but we're all the rest of us are here.
I explained earlier that we have a number of amendments that we would like to have engrossed into an A engrossed version, a nice clean copy that everybody can look at and work off of. And so at this time, the chair would accept a motion to adopt amendments 237-1 and in addition agriculture for Oregon legislative proposal on tax amendments. That does people have copies?
They don't, if they want to look at it.
Okay, if you need to look at it before, this is not a substantive decision we're making. It is a decision only to get all of the proposed amendments into one piece of paper.
Mr. Chairman, the ones you were referring to were the ones that related to subsection 13, sub B. Are those the ones we haven't seen? I don't have the amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Here's a copy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would move the adoption of the amendments that the bill be printed in gross and returned to the committee.
Okay, is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman. I don't know. I haven't had a chance to go over these, and I don't want it suggested that I'm even encouraging this, because I have a complete set of amendments that I intend to offer either as amendments or a minority report, and so I don't want to show, if you have enough votes to do it without me, I'm going to vote no, because frankly, I think we're rushing this too much, and I am concerned about several issues that have been brought up in this bill, and so if you can, fine, I'm not going to delay you. I'll vote to get them engrossed if I have to, but I in no way want to lend support to the amendments or this bill at this time.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Roberts.
Before Senator Day was here, the acting chairman indicated that the purpose of this was clearly not to either endorse the bill or the amendments, but to get a version before us so that those who were going to testify on it would have a clean version in front of them.
Okay.
So it was not.
All right,
this is not intended to be an approval of the amendments.
Todd,
the problem.